Hello, and welcome to Shaking Scripture's Leaves, a podcast where we think through Scripture, one passage, one topic at a time, until we have shaken all of its leaves. This week, we are actually going to be getting back to Ecclesiastes. So, specifically, we're going to be going back to Ecclesiastes chapter 3, and we're going to be going through verses 1 through 14. And I'm actually very excited about this section. I've been studying over the course of the past couple of weeks, and it's been very encouraging to me and timely to me with some of the anxieties that I've been feeling over the last few weeks. And so I'm hoping that it's going to end up being helpful to you guys as well. And maybe you will or you won't have some of the same anxieties that I do. But in the way that Ecclesiastes has been extremely encouraging to me, as much as I can, I'd like to help other people to see Ecclesiastes through my eyes. Because I think that Ecclesiastes often has the reputation of being such a downer of a book, and yet there's few books in the Bible that have given me greater sources of encouragement just in the way that Solomon looks at life. And Ecclesiastes chapter 3, specifically the section that we're going to be talking about today, might actually be the foremost example of that in the book for me. So I am very stoked to bring you through this, and this episode is titled Welcome to Sovereignty. And we're going to be getting into why that is, basically at verse 1. Now, the first thing that I need to walk through before we actually start reading any of the stuff that's here is that Ecclesiastes chapter 3, verses 1 through 8, is a poem that Solomon includes in the book. And so there are some aspects of the poem that I do want to walk through, but I also want to make sure that I say one of the things that has been disappointing to me is that when I read Ecclesiastes 3, 1 through 8 in Hebrew, there are things that stand out to me that are able to indicate things about the structure, which it's a poem. So there's a lot of things that I can't translate into English. Like, I'm not going to be able to show you the way that the words rhyme. And Hebrew doesn't rhyme the same way that English does, but there is stuff like that that's happening in this poem that I can't translate for you. And that's cool. And you should learn Hebrew. But there are structural things that are very, very clear in Hebrew that it takes a bit of finesse to translate them into English, but they are very much able to be translated into English. And so before this episode, I went through several English translations, the King James Version, the NASB, I went through the LSB, I went through the Christian Standard Bible, I went through the NRSV, I went through Young's Literal Translation, and I was trying to find a translation that actually takes care to translate those structural markers so that you can see the structure of the poem, and none of them did. And so that was something that was very disappointing for me. And so the thing that I'm going to point out to you is, I'm going to read just chapter 3, verses 1 through 8, I'm going to read this very slowly and intentionally, and I have tried my best to translate this into English in such a way that if you write it down and you look at it closely, you will see in English the things that I see in Hebrew. And that's what I'm hoping that this is partially going to be a resource for. But first of all, let me read the poem, and then I'm going to start going through the things that are significant about it. So verse 1, an appointed time for everything. And a time for every matter under the sun. A time for begetting, and a time for dying. A time for planting, and a time for uprooting what has been planted. A time for killing, and a time for healing. A time for demolishing, and a time for building. A time for weeping, and a time for laughing. A time of mourning, and a time of dancing. A time for throwing stones, and a time of gathering stones. A time for embracing, and a time for withdrawing from embracing. A time for seeking, and a time for losing. A time for keeping, and a time for discarding. A time for tearing, and a time for sowing. A time for being silent, and a time for speaking. A time for loving, and a time for hating. A time of war, and a time of peace. And so that is the poem. And even without me going further into any of the structure that's here, some of the things that you're going to obviously tell is that the entire poem is arranged into these couplets of something good and something bad. And sometimes it's something good and something bad, sometimes it's something bad and something good. But it goes into these couplets, and you can tell that it's moving from good to bad, just in a flow. Now, some of the structural things that I want to point out and that were intentional I can't go through every structural thing that exists in this poem. I spent some time trying to figure out how I could, but it's difficult to do in a verbal format. Like, if I had a whiteboard and I could draw pictures and write this out for you, then I'd be able to say a lot more. And so maybe if you write out those verses, you'll be able to take some time to go through the specific structural things at play. But there are a couple things that I can bring to bear for you. So from verses 2 until verse 8, you'll see that structure of a time for begetting and a time for dying. That's three words. A time is one word. That word for, that's a preposition, that's one word. And then begetting, a time for dying, a time for killing, a time for healing. So you can see that it has that structure of time, for, and then verb. A verbal idea of something that's ongoing. And so that word's actually there. But if you'll notice at the end of verse 4 that it was a little bit different. I didn't say a time for weeping and a time for laughing, a time for mourning and a time for dancing. And that's how a lot of translations will translate that verse. But I translated the difference that exists in Hebrew, because it says a time for weeping and a time for laughing. You can see that that word for is still there. But then in the second half of verse 4, it says a time of mourning and a time of dancing. And what that actually is in the Hebrew is just a time mourning and a time dancing. So a word was intentionally taken out by the author there, and it certainly draws your attention to that portion of the poem. And then at the end, in verse 8, you see a similar thing happen again at the second half of verse 8, where verse 8 is a time for loving and a time for hating, a time of war and a time of peace. Where again, it's just a time war and a time peace. That preposition has been taken out. Additionally, where everything else is verbal ideas, the end of verse 8 is war and peace. So it's a sudden shift from a verb to a noun. And so all of that is just to say that the poem structurally places specific emphasis on a time of mourning and a time of dancing, and it places specific emphasis on a time of war and a time of peace. So in the poem, those are the two couples that are specifically emphasized by Solomon. And we're going to be getting into that more in a moment, but first I want to backtrack to verse 1. Because I told you in the introduction that this was a poem about God's sovereignty. So in verse 1, there's a translational issue that I'd like to address. A lot of translations are going to translate verse 1, there is a season for everything, and there is a time for every matter under the sun. Where they translate it, season and time. And so in Hebrew, those are two different words for the word time. So there's an appointed time for everything is what I translated it as. And that's a single word, one word for time. And then there's a time for every matter under the sun. And that's the second word for time. And that's just the more common one. It just means time. And so the challenge with translating that season and time is that I understand what translators are going for. It's two words for time, and if they just say a time for everything and a time for every matter, then you won't understand that that was a separate word. But the difficulty is, when an English speaker hears the word a time, like when we say time, it's a reference to just like a specific point in time, and that specific point might be larger or smaller, but we're thinking of a specific point in time. Whereas when we hear season, we hear, oh yeah, an extended period of one kind of time or another. And so we think that the difference being drawn out is there's a specific time versus a period of time. And so for an English speaker reading most translations of Ecclesiastes, that's what you think Solomon's getting after. He's saying, hey, there are specific times of this, that, or the other, and there are extended periods of this, that, or the other. And that's very much not what he's saying. Like that word appointed time, it shows up three other times in the Old Testament, and the nuance there is not a duration of time. The nuance there is that it is a time that is chosen by an authority. And so the other uses of this word appear in Esther, and they appear in Nehemiah, where at the end of the book of Esther, you have this entire story of Esther, where God is delivering his people Israel in the context of the Persian Empire, and he does it without performing any miracles. Where God just operates through providence. He operates through a bunch of random chance to bring about the salvation of his people. And so At the end of that, they appoint the Feast of Lots, which we might call the Feast of Die or the Feast of a Coin Toss. And it's to remember the time that God saved his people just essentially by presiding over acts of chance. And at the end of that book, one of the uses of this word shows up. And so I'm only going to read one. It's used twice, but in Esther chapter 9, verse 31, that these days of Purim, which is the festival that Mordecai and Queen Esther instate, that these days of Purim should be observed at their appointed times. That's this word. As Mordecai the Jew and Queen Esther obligated them, and as they had obligated themselves and their offspring with regard to their fasts and their lamenting. So you can see in that situation, Queen Esther and Mordecai the Jew, those are Jews that are in a position of authority, and they have selected a time that they are now requiring these other Jews to perform some festival. So this is an appointed time, and it's a chosen time, and it is a time that is chosen by someone who has the authority to choose it. Another use of it is in Nehemiah chapter 2, verse 6, where Nehemiah is talking to the king about potentially having the opportunity to go and rebuild the walls of Jerusalem, the temple in Jerusalem. And so Nehemiah 2, 6, and the king said to me, the queen sitting beside him, how long will you be gone and when will you return? So it pleased the king to send me when I had given him a time. And that word is this word, an appointed time. So the king has given Nehemiah the authority to choose a specific time. Nehemiah chooses a time and tells the king what it is. So this word is not the word for some extended duration of one kind of time or another. This word is specifically a reference to the fact that a time has been selected. And so that's the significant thing. And if you miss that, then you're going to miss the primary emphasis of this poem. Because I said earlier that this is a sovereignty poem. This is a poem about the fact that good times and bad times are going to move through your life, but it's not just that the good times and the bad times move through your life, it's the fact that the good times and the bad times move through your life at the times that were chosen for them. And who did that choosing? God. And so this is a poem about God's sovereignty. And so those are the two different applications that we are supposed to read this poem and then dwell on and consider. Because first of all, you can tell just listening to the poem, a time for begetting and a time for dying. Begetting, the birth of a child, that's a very positive thing. And then dying, that's a not so positive thing. It's a bit of a downer. A time for planting and time for uprooting what has been planted. There's a time for productive labor, and then there's also a time for just getting rid of something. A time for killing and a time for healing. A time for demolishing and a time for building. A time for weeping and a time of laughing. That you're moving between good times and bad times. And so if I were to summarize this poem, the way that I would summarize it, specifically just the movement of good to bad, is a very famous saying, this too shall pass. That one of the things that you are supposed to understand about the life in which we live is that there are good times and there are bad times. And when you are in the bad times, you can actually be encouraged by the fact that bad times aren't permanent. You don't spend your entire life in a low. And even if someone's entire life on average is worse than someone else's, or someone's life is on average better than someone else's, for every individual person, as well as for societies at large, we go through these ebbs and flows where in the course of your life, you're going to go through times that are particularly good. And in the course of your life, you're going to go through times that are particularly bad. And I would also bring you back to, we said that this poem specifically emphasizes the second half of verse 4, a time of mourning and a time of dancing. And it emphasizes the end of verse 8, a time of war and a time of peace. And so the point that I would make there is that verse 4, that's a very personal thing. It's your subjective understanding of the world around you, a time of mourning and a time of dancing. This is a time where, regardless of what's happening with society at large, regardless of what's happening with whatever is going on around you, you yourself are going to go through times of mourning where you are feeling down. And you're going to go through times of dancing where you are feeling elated. And that may or may not be connected to the objective realities that are happening outside of you. And at the same time, when we see at the end of verse 8, a time of war and a time of peace. There's going to be times where you subjectively go through good times and bad times, and then there are also going to be times where just the external objective reality is that this is a bad time or this is a good time. And again, that happens on individual levels, but then that also happens on societal levels. That happens at national levels. That happens at the world level. That the world is going to go through periods of warfare and peace. That a nation is going to go through periods of prosperity and want. That a town is going to go through cycles of good times and bad times. A family is going to go through good times and bad times that are genuinely good and genuinely bad. And then that's inclusive of the reality that you individually or a group individually is going to experience good and bad. That the subjective experience of good and bad and the objective experience of good and bad both are going to be in this cycle of ebbs and flows. And so, some lessons that we should learn from that. When you're going through a good time, you shouldn't have the expectation that that good time lasts forever. It never will. And then by the same token, when you're going through a bad time, you can be encouraged by the reality that the bad time is not permanent either. That there might be a level of suffering that goes through that is persistent in your life, but as a general rule, you're going to get through the bad times. And so in a good time, you are taught to be humble and to be prepared for and cognizant of the reality that bad times will come. And in the bad times, you are able to be encouraged by the reality that this is not all there is. This is not all that there's going to be. Those are awesome. Those are fantastic. And that's only one half of the lesson that we are supposed to be learning from this poem. The second lesson that we're supposed to be learning from this poem comes from the fact that it's a sovereignty poem. That this is a poem about the fact that it's not just that good times come and bad times come. It's the fact that good times come when God decides they're going to come. And it's the fact that bad times come when God decides they're going to come. That in your life, in your own personal life, the good times are going to arrive no sooner than God decides that they will. And the good times are going to last no longer than God decides that they will. And in like manner, the bad times are going to show up no later than God decides that they're going to show up. And the bad times are going to be around for no shorter than God decides they're going to be around. And so in the good times, there are some seriously incredible things that we should be gleaning from the reality that God is in control of our lives. I mean, James 1:17 talks about the fact that every generous act and every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father in lights, in whom there is no variation or shadow of turning. One of the things that we're supposed to remember is the fact that God's the one who gives us good gifts. That when you're experiencing a good time, it's not just the fact that like, oh, good times have randomly come to me. I'm randomly having some good experiences because that's just how life works. Like, no, God's not just sitting up in heaven and then people experience good apart from him. No, when you're going through a good season in your life, when you're watching a really good movie and you're having some fantastic family time with your brothers and sisters or your wife or your husband, when you're able to experience a season of just unmitigated amazing, it's not just that God allowed that to happen, it's that God gave that to you. That God gave you that gift. And so, as Christians especially, when we're experiencing the good times in our lives and we are dwelling on the fact that the good times come directly from the hands of God, there's a response that that's supposed to have from us. And 1 Thessalonians 5:16 through 18 says this: rejoice always, pray constantly, give thanks in everything. For this is God's will for you in Christ Jesus. That good times will come and go, and they come in the appointed times that God has set for them. And that should have some very real application in our thanksgiving and gratitude. That we should be grateful for the good times that come because those came from God. Both on the individual level of, I am personally going through a good time right now, but then also at the national level, that when our country is going through a season of prosperity, God's the one who provided for that. And so that should inform our attitude in those times. And then likewise, when I think about the fact that God is the one who is in control of when the bad times come, when I'm able to dwell on the fact that God is in direct control over that, that's an encouraging thing as well. I think about Romans 8:28, that God works all things together for the good of those who love him, who are called according to his purpose. That if you're a Christian, God loves you. And not only does God love you, but God has literally promised in Romans 8:28, God has promised every Christian that every single thing that happens in your life is for your good. That God is not just allowing you to suffer because it's something that his hands are tied, he has to do it, but that God allows you to suffer and God actually brings suffering into your life because he loves you. That the bad things that you experience, you can draw encouragement from the fact that that's coming from the hand of a loving father who is in direct control of exactly the amount of suffering that you're going to go through. And so, when I think about that in practice, like the reason that this has been such a significant thing for me is that especially over the course of the last few months, I've been looking around at the world ahead. Like I'm about to get married. At the time I'm recording this, I'm going to be getting married in about a week and a half. And something that dawned on me and just hit me like a ton of bricks is I'm going to be married to this girl for the rest of my life or for the rest of her life. And then she's going to be married to me for the rest of my life or the rest of her life. Like, till death do us part. And one of the things that just absolutely hit me is I realized if I make a really, really bad decision and I do something that just absolutely wrecks my life, I don't just wreck my life, I wreck Lily's life. By the same token, if I do something that's great, then hey, I benefit and so does Lily. But then there's also the reality that if Lily does something great, we both benefit. And in the same way that if I do something royally stupid, we both suffer, if Lily does something royally stupid, we both suffer. Like now I'm in a situation where if good and bad goes through my life, it goes through Lily's life too. And if good or bad goes through Lily's life, it goes through my life too. And it kind of dawned on me like that, the pressure and the responsibility of if I'm an idiot, I don't just ruin my life anymore. And so I've been thinking about in my own personal life, the avenues through which success or suffering are able to absolutely nail me and now Lily have just doubled. And that's kind of an anxiety producing thing when I think about those things. And so I've been thinking about that a lot more where I've just been on, like the future has been on my mind and the fact that good and bad is coming my way has been on my mind. And then also at a larger scale, when I think about the United States, like there's a lot of things that are happening in our country that are extremely concerning to me. There are things happening in our economy that are extremely concerning to me. There are things happening in our political class, the corruption that is just all over the place, and the almost blatant incompetence, perhaps even intentional incompetence that I see among our leaders. That's concerning to me. It's highly concerning to me. And I dwell on the fact that across history, like our world is covered in the ruins of empires that thought that they were going to last forever. And the United States is no different. The American Empire will not last forever. And we've had a period of extraordinary prosperity, and we've had a period of really, really good stuff. That is not going to last forever. It never has. It never will. And so I've been looking at those kinds of things, and I see the problems that exist in our politics and our economy and just the moral state of our country. Like, I see those things, and I'm just like, are we going to make it the next 50 years? And so that kind of a thing has been a massive source of anxiety for me over the course of the last few months. And then I come to this passage, and I see, okay, good times come, good times go. Bad times come, bad times go. And that's actually something that is bigger than I am able to control. Like, I do not have the ability to make the United States all of a sudden be as it should be. I do not have the ability in and of myself to make the country last 10, 20, 30 years longer than it otherwise would. I don't have the ability to make the country last one day longer than it would. And in a similar way, I also don't have control over the good or the bad things that are going to come into my life. I don't have control of what disease I'm going to get. I don't have control over whether or not I find out that I have cancer in 2 years. I don't have control over whether or not I get into a car accident. Like, there's a level of control I have over that one, but there's also a sense in which I really don't. The reality is, in my life individually, but also the state of the country and the state of the world at large, the amount of control that I have is extraordinarily limited. And that's not to say that there's no control I have, but my life is lived at the mercy of God's sovereignty. And good times will come and good times will go, and bad times will come and bad times will go. And I actually can't stop that process. I can't do anything that makes it so that my life is always in a high. I can't do anything to make sure that my life never hits a low. And in the same way, you can't do anything to make it so that your life is always in a high, and you can't do anything to make it so that your life is never in a low. All of that is ultimately outside of our control. And so the fact that, first of all, Solomon just gives us that somber reminder that I shouldn't be trying to concern myself with, how do I try to control everything in my environment? How do I control everything that exists in my life? That one of the things that Solomon has to say to us is, hey man, pump your jets. You actually can't control that. God's sovereignty is bigger than you are. This world is bigger than you are. And hate to break it to you, but your life is bigger than you are. You can't control that. You're not able to. And so, for one thing, Solomon just takes it off the table. And so, the next thing now is he doesn't leave you there. This chapter, or I should say this half of the chapter, is about, okay, let's set up God's sovereignty, the fact that good and bad will come. But then how do you deal with that? How are you supposed to live in light of that? The reality that when good comes your way, bad is on its way to take it away from you, but also the fact that when bad is here, it can get better. What are you supposed to do to now enjoy your life as much as possible in light of that? Okay. Well, that's the next section. And so let's read verse 9. What profit does the worker have in that which he toils? I have seen the task which God has given to the sons of Adam to concern themselves with. He has made everything fitting in its time, and he has also set eternity in their hearts. Man cannot find out the works which God has done from beginning to end. And so, before we get into the solution to the issue of God's sovereignty, there's actually another thing that Solomon now sets up. I guess saying God would have also been accurate, because God's also writing this. Okay. But what profit does the worker have in that which he toils? I have seen the task which God has given to the sons of Adam to concern themselves with, which you'll notice that I'm very intentionally translating that Adam. And that actually is the Hebrew word Adam, which is the name of Adam. And then also it's just a word for mankind. But in the course of Ecclesiastes, I am intentionally translating that Adam, because Solomon actually makes a lot of allusions to Genesis. And we'll get to that next week, or I should say next episode. But I'm just going to call that out here. He has made every, and this is the verse 11. This is the big one. He has made everything fitting in its time, and he has also set eternity in their hearts. Man cannot find out the works which God has done from beginning to end. So the first thing that we see is God has set eternity in the hearts of man. And so one of the things that Ecclesiastes has already been dealing with a lot, and that Solomon is going to continue to deal with, is the mortality of man. The fact that your life is always lived in the shadow of death, the impending march of your own mortality. And yet, we don't feel that way. As a person, we have a lot of interest in what came before us. And when I think about my life and when I think about my perception of history, my perception of history does not begin with November 10th, 1999, when I was born. Like, when I think back into history, I think back a lot further than my own lifespan. I think back, I think back to creation and actually before that. And I think about the history of mankind, and the history of mankind is very personal to me, and it feels like my history, even though I wasn't there for any of it. And in the same way, as I turn towards the other horizon, as people, we are very interested in the things that are going to come after us. We're so preoccupied with, well, first of all, what's going to happen to me after I die? Am I going to turn into nothing? Am I going to rot away? Am I going to continue to live on? Am I going to live on in paradise? Am I going to live on in suffering? Like, what's going to happen to me after I die? But then also, what is the progression of history going to be after I die? The same way that my perception of history doesn't begin with my birthday, my perception of the future does not end with the day that I die. We are very much preoccupied with what comes after us. We think about the inheritance that we're going to leave our children. We think about the legacy that we're going to try to leave up for ourselves after we're gone. We talk about that in Ecclesiastes chapter 2 and a bit in Ecclesiastes chapter 1. We are very much concerned with the flow of time far beyond the boundaries of our own personal life. And so one of the things that is interesting to observe is the fact that I would point out every single one of us is immortal. Like, every single one of us is an immortal being. All of us are immortal beings living mortal lives. And our frame cannot reconcile our eternality with our mortality. That you are going to live forever, and yet you're not going to live forever here. This life is not going to be eternal. And so that doesn't mean that our souls are any more used to mortality because that's what our bodies are ultimately suffering from. Like, we are eternal beings and we don't think as though we're going to die. Every single time someone dies, they had plans for next week. And so that's an interesting thing, that God has intentionally set us up so that we actually can't get our minds off of our own mortality, but instead, like, what other animal has midlife crises? What other animal is leaving an inheritance for its kids? What other animal is trying to figure out what history was like before it was here? What other animal is so concerned with what's going to come after it? None of them. It's just us. We're the ones who are concerned with what came before us. We're the ones who are concerned with what comes after us. And also, we are the ones who are concerned with what we were before we existed and what we will be after we die. God has given that sense and given that interest to people. And so, first of all, that is a unique feature that God has given us. And it's an important thing for us to have because it ultimately opens us up to the reality of God and the eternality of our own existence. Like, Romans 1 has some things to say about that. But the second half of that God has set eternity into the hearts of men, and yet man cannot find out the works which God has done from beginning to end. In other words, no matter how much you study, you're never going to have time. You're not going to have time to study everything. You're not going to have time to see everything that you'd like to see. You're not going to be able to travel to every location you'd like to be at, but also you're not going to see every event that you'd like to see. The American Founding Fathers may have been very interested to see what industrialization would do to this country. They may have been very interested to see the invention of the computer. They may have been very interested to see all of the events that have transpired after they've died, and yet they didn't have time to see all of God's story. And so despite the fact that we have such an interest in what came before us and what comes after us, we are not going to have the ability to actually see everything we'd like to see, either everything that's on the earth or everything in terms of historical events. And we're not going to have time to do all of the things that we'd like to do. Each of us has a longer bucket list than we're actually going to be able to cross everything off of. And sometimes that's an explicit bucket list where you've actually written it out, and sometimes that's all the things that didn't make it to the paper, but things that you would have liked to have done. Like, we are forced to live our lives with a scarcity of time, and yet we are eternal beings. And so that scarcity of time and that pending mortality, it's just, it inflicts suffering on us. And so we're toiling in this life, but also we don't have the time to do all of the things that we'd like to do, but that rubs right up against the reality that we have such an incredible interest in the things that lie outside the boundaries of our lifespan. That God has set eternity in our hearts, and yet in this life we will never be able to satisfy the thing that rests so deeply within us. And so there's those two aspects. The fact that God is sovereign and that life moves on cycles of good and bad, ultimately controlled by God's sovereignty, as well as the reality that we ourselves as eternal beings are so scrunched up by the tight boundaries of our mortality. And so the thing that Solomon says about that is that now Solomon gives you the wisdom that you need to live your life and enjoy it in light of these realities. And in verse 12, he says, I know that there is nothing good for any of them than to rejoice and to do good in his life. In verse 13, and also that every man will eat and drink and experience good in all his labor which God has given to him. In other words, what's the good thing? Like, I'm actually going to, like, let me just dive into that a little bit, actually. Verse 12, when he says, there is nothing good for any of them other than to rejoice and do good in his life. The thing that Solomon says is, he doesn't say the best thing is for them to rejoice and do good in their lives. He says, no, there's actually nothing good in this life for you to do. And again, we're talking under the sun, so we got to remember the larger context of Ecclesiastes that we're in. Solomon is considering this life by its own merits. He says, the only good thing that life has to offer you is for you to enjoy yourself. The good thing that life has for you is to rejoice and do good, and to enjoy the food and the beverages and the experiences and even the work that God has given to you. Again, this is a reality. God is sovereign. He's not just allowing you to experience the good things that you have in your life. He's giving them to you. God, as a good father, as a generous giver, is giving you the good that you have in your life. He's not just letting it happen. He is giving it to you. And that's a drum that I can't beat enough. We need to understand the good that exists in this life is directly from the hands of God. And so I want to apply this back to the issue of sovereignty. What are you supposed to do to enjoy your life as much as possible when you recognize the reality that good times are not going to stick around and bad times are on their way? Well, you should enjoy the good times. Like, the fact that you know that this good time is not going to exist permanently, that should result in you savoring it. You should make an intentional effort to just sit in the good and enjoy that sunset, enjoy that movie, enjoy cuddling up with your significant other. Enjoy that good conversation with your brother. Enjoy that really nice hamburger. Enjoy that lovely cup of coffee that you got at that really expensive coffee shop. I don't know. I'm listing off some of the things that I enjoy. Fill in your own blank. Like, what are the things that you just... oh, that's the spice of life right there. When you understand that the good seasons of your life are temporary and the bad times are coming, and when you understand that you actually can't stop the bad times from coming and you can't in your own power make it so that the good times last forever, like when you understand that, the result is that you should make a specific effort to enjoy the good times while you have them. Because ultimately, if you're in a good time, if you are in a period of God's blessing in your life or God's blessing in your context, in your environment, in your culture, in your country, if you are in a period of subjective or surrounding good, and then you spend all of that time just racking yourself with anxiety about the fact that bad times might be coming, and all of the time that you have in the good times, you're just thinking about all the things that could go wrong and might go wrong and that you can't actually stop. And oh my goodness, what if this thing happens? If in the good times you sacrifice all of the good that you could have experienced to instead rack yourself with anxiety about the bad that might come, like, that's just foolish. You have been given this good gift. You have been given this good season, and you are wasting that good season stressing out about the bad that may or may not come. And in a sense, like, the bad times are gonna come, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the bad time has to be catastrophic. The bad time will come, but the bad time doesn't have to be that, like, everything is irreparably ruined. Like, the bad time that's coming in the course of the next 10 years, the United States is going to have bad times. the bad times that's coming, the bad times that come in the next 10 years, they don't necessarily have to be the collapse of the American empire. Like, it could just be that we have a recession for a little while, and then things kick back into gear, and a lot of things start being nice again. Like, that could be the dip that happens. It could also be that in, like, 10 years from now, the United States isn't going to be the United States anymore. Like, that could happen. But that's not where we are right now. And so for me to be in a situation where right now I'm still in a context where I am experiencing so much of God's blessing, I shouldn't squander all of that time stressing out about what might come in the future. Good times will come. Bad times will come. You should enjoy the good times. And even in the bad times, you should do what you can to actually enjoy those too. And this is one of the lessons from Ecclesiastes that has been so significant for me. And not just here in Ecclesiastes chapter 3, but we're going to be approaching it from another angle again in Ecclesiastes chapter 6. One of the most profound lessons that I have learned from Ecclesiastes is that the best way to prepare for tomorrow is to enjoy today. And if that's a lesson that you can learn in your life, like, I've just got to tell you, that's one of the most important lessons I have ever learned in my life. It makes my life so much better. That when every single day comes, the thing that I am trying to do is I'm trying to enjoy the day that God has given me. I'm trying to enjoy the blessings of that individual day. And even if it's a bad day, it doesn't mean that there's no good to be enjoyed in it. And if I can learn to really enjoy the good times, and if I can learn to even enjoy the bad times as much as I can, my entire life is going to be made so much better if I'm able to practice that discipline. And by the same token, your entire life will be made so much better if you can learn to just really capitalize on the good times God gives you and try to squeeze the good you can out of the bad times that come your way. Because the good times and the bad times will come, and that's not always in your control. And yet, if you can learn to enjoy either one, that's amazing. And the thing that I think about is the fact that if I'm always fretting, and if I can never enjoy today because I'm trying to prepare for and control tomorrow, then when tomorrow comes, it's just going to be another today. And I'm going to be stressed out, and I'm not going to be able to enjoy tomorrow in the same way that I wasn't able to enjoy today. But if I am able to make the discipline of, I am going to enjoy today, and I am going to learn to enjoy today, then when tomorrow comes, that's going to be another today. And if I can learn to enjoy every today, then I will also be learning to enjoy every tomorrow. And so good times and bad times will come. And the solution that Solomon gives you for that is to enjoy. If you know that good times and bad times are going to come and that that's ultimately outside of your control, then you need to learn to enjoy today. Don't stress out about the rest of that. The future is not in your hands. Jesus said that each day's trouble is sufficient for itself. You shouldn't be worried and so stressed out about what tomorrow brings. Focus on today. Focus on the responsibilities that you have today, and focus on the enjoyment that God has given you today. And in fact, that leads me into the second point about this. I was talking to Lily about this chapter, and she made an observation, which, I mean, Lily is my fiance, soon to be wife. Probably the next time you hear an episode from this, she'll be my wife by then. Unless, like, I don't know, one of us dies. But when I was talking to Lily about this, one of the observations that she made about the chapter is that Solomon does not say, enjoy today by being a hedonist and this don't do anything productive and just eat and drink yourself into a stupor. And you know what? Like, give yourself liver disease. Just go for it, bro. That's not what Solomon says. Ecclesiastes is not a book of hedonism. Ecclesiastes is a book of Epicureanism. But one of the things that Solomon specifically talks about is, hey, rejoice and do good. Notice that. Rejoice, enjoy yourself, and do good. Verse 12, rejoice and do good. Verse 13, you should eat and drink and experience good in all your labor that God has given you. And so one of the things that I would encourage you with is the fact that you can't single-handedly change the world, but it doesn't mean you can't do anything. Like, the two extremes that people can end up on is you might have someone who says, man, one person can change the entire world. No. One person can't change the entire world. But sometimes people learn that one person can't change the entire world, and then they go all the way to the other side and they say, you know what? I can't do anything. I have no control over anything, and I can have no impact because I can't change the world on my own. And that's wrong too. It is not true that you on your own are going to be able to change the entire world, but it's also not true that you don't have any impact. In your life, in your family, you have an impact there. In your work, your job, you have an impact there. In your church, you have an impact there. And in your larger community, you have an impact there. Like, the thing is, hey, I do not have the ability to just snap my fingers and make the entire abortion industry in the United States go away. I do not have that ability. But I know people who have volunteered in pregnancy centers. And when that girl is sitting in front of you, and I'm thinking about some situations that I'm aware of, actually. When a girl is sitting in front of you, and she says to you, I'm 17 years old, I'm pregnant, and my parents have told me, if you do not abort this baby, if you decide that you're going to bring this baby to term, we will kick you out. You will have no support from us. We will not help you with this child. Like, when you have a girl in that situation, and she's kind of being forced to get the abortion, which, interestingly enough, just kind of a fun tidbit, the main reason, like, when women who get abortions are asked why they got an abortion, the main reason is that they felt that they didn't have a choice. Which is very ironic, considering that the pro-child murder people like to identify as pro-choice. But that's an entire aside. So, but when you have a girl in front of you and she's saying, my parents are going to kick me out of the house if I choose to keep this baby. And then you reach out to your church and you say, hey, there's a girl pregnant who, if she keeps the baby, she will get kicked out of her house. Who in this church is available? Who in this church is going to step up and invite her into their home and support her? And as a church family, let's support her to be able to raise this kid and take care of it. And pregnancy centers, that when the mother comes to term, they teach her, hey, how do you breastfeed? How do you care for this baby? How do you change a diaper? They equip mothers to then care for the children that they're trying to encourage them to keep. That you might not have been able to end the abortion industry, but that's a child that's going to live because of your impact. That's a mother who's going to have a place to stay and support in being a mother because you helped her. You might not have changed the world, but you sure changed her world. And you changed the world of her child. Or even if you're like working at your job, and in your job, there's someone who's way younger than you, so much further behind in their career than you are in yours. And then you know what? You reach into their life and you say, hey, I'm going to teach you how to be really good at this. I'm going to give you an opportunity to just completely blow up your career. I'm going to give you an opportunity to learn what I know. And I am going to use the advantage that I have of where I am in my career to help you. You might not have changed the world. You might not have changed the industry, but you changed that person's world. And something even more general, just because we're all, you know, we're Christians, when you share the gospel with someone and that person becomes a Christian, that is a soul that was going to spend eternity in hell that is now going to instead spend eternity in heaven, a world that is very much not the Ecclesiastes world. You might not have changed this world, but you actually have changed something more significant when you bring a soul into salvation. And I mean, hey, I should note that that portion is very much not what Solomon is talking about in Ecclesiastes chapter 3. Like, again, Ecclesiastes chapter 3, we're in the section of Ecclesiastes where we're talking about life under the sun. Like, we are very much not dealing with eternity. But as Christians, when we're thinking about the fact that we can't change this world, but there is an impact that we are able to have, as Christians, we should be fully aware that one of the impacts that we are able to have, and in fact, Matthew 28, the Great Commission, like the impact that we are supposed to have, is that we are able to pluck souls from fire, that we are able to pluck brands out of the fire and bring them into eternal life. That is part of the impact that you are able to have, and that is part of the work that you are supposed to be occupying yourself with. That as a Christian on the earth, that you are an evangelist, you are an agent of eternity to bring people into life. And so, absolutely, we want to learn what Ecclesiastes has to say about enjoying our life and enjoying the good gifts that God gives us. But while you're here, you are supposed to be learning and disciplining yourself to enjoy the gifts that God gives you. And also, God has given you the responsibility to, as verse 12 says, do good in your life. God has given you labor, as verse 13 says. And that's your job, that's your role in your community, that's your role in your family, and you are able to have an impact there. And again, you're not changing the world, but that's a world you are changing. And it's also true that as Christians, we are supposed to be occupied with the task that our Savior and our King has given us. And that includes salvation for the people that are lost in the world. And so, I don't want to not mention that just because we're in Ecclesiastes. Like, that's something that I meditate on and that I think you should be meditating on as you read this. And so, God is sovereign. Life goes through good and bad. And we should respond to that by enjoying the good and, frankly, learning to enjoy the bad times as well. And by occupying ourselves with the work that God has for us, both mundane and very spiritual. And ultimately, nothing is mundane. And we're supposed to be enjoying it. And you shouldn't be stressing yourself out about what lies in the future. And so now, I want to comment on verse 14 next before we sign off. But verse 14. I know that everything God will do will stand until eternity. On top of it, there is nothing to add. And from it, there is nothing to take away. God has made that which they will fear before him. So, this is a very interesting thing to be getting at the end of this section. Because again, this is a section about God's sovereignty and living in light of God's sovereignty. God has made. Like, when we talk about that word made, by the way, it can be the idea of making something, but it can also just be the idea of doing something. That God has done the thing that results in people fearing before him. Or God has made the thing that results in people fearing before him. Either way, the actions of God in this situation are motivated by a desire of people fearing before him. And if you know Proverbs, then you know that the fear of God is the beginning of wisdom. And so God has actually ordered life. The sovereignty poem shows that God has set up life where we are forced to recognize something about God and something about ourselves. Which, before I get into the specific thing that we're supposed to learn, I think it's an encouraging thing to recognize that God has specifically designed the world to be instructive. That God has designed the world to teach us things about him. That on its own is a very kind and generous thing that God gives to us. That the world is designed so that it teaches us things about God, but then also it's the flow of time. That the flow of your life is going to teach you things about God. That in my life, God is bringing me on a very specific track that he has coursed for me. That I am going to live a life that is different than the life that any other person lives, and that God is going to teach me unique angles of himself through my life that I'm going to learn in a different way than my dad learned, than my friend learned, than my fiance has learned. That the lessons that God teaches us are going to be similar but different. That each of us is going to have a very specific story of God's teaching and God's sovereignty and God's provision and God's love and God's training and God's discipline. That my story is different than the story of any other Christian. And so I have a very unique angle on God through my own experience that is different than the angle on God that my brothers and sisters are going to have. That when we're in heaven, we're going to be able to hear about the story that God had written for each of our brothers and sisters in different geopolitical areas and in different time periods. I'm going to be able to hear about God's faithfulness to a man who lived in 700 AD. I'm going to be able to hear about God's faithfulness to a Christian in the Roman Empire. I'm going to be able to hear about God's faithfulness to a Christian in China in the ancient times. And I'm going to be able to learn interesting things about God from the angle on him that I see from their stories. And they're going to be able to learn an interesting thing about God from the angle that they see of him through my story. That your life, that the flow of your life is going to teach you things about God, and that the flow of time and life and the world in general is designed to teach us about God. And that that is on its own an act of generosity and goodness that God gives to us. And so, specifically, the lesson that Solomon is emphasizing when his discussion about God's sovereignty is the fact that life is structured in such a way that we are forced to recognize the fact that we are at the mercy of God's sovereignty. That the rivers of time flow on the course that God has charted. Nations will rise and fall at God's whim. And no nation is going to be everlasting except for the one that God himself instates with Jesus Christ at its head. That will be the kingdom that goes off into eternity and no other. That your life individually, like not just the big scale stuff that God's in control over that are going to go through ebbs and flows of good and bad, but your life specifically. Your cup will either overflow or run empty at God's command. And God has appointed boundaries where you are going to rejoice in the good that God has given you. And God has appointed boundaries where you're going to say with David, even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death. And in all of those situations, you're supposed to recognize God is in control of that. And also, if you're a Christian, then God is with you in that. So God is sovereignly in control over the entire world, over every community, over every nation, and over every life and individual. God is in control over my life. God is in control over your life. And his world and our lives are specifically designed so that they go from good to bad, so that we are forced to recognize our own lack of control. Because if I were in control of my own life, it wouldn't go through bad seasons. If I were in control of the United States, it wouldn't be in decline. And not in the sense that, like, if I were at the head, I'd be able to make it go right. But in the sense that I don't have the power to make the United States be good and stay good. I don't have the power to make California be good or stay good. I don't have the power to make the world be in a time of everlasting peace. Like, I don't have that power. And yet that has a lot of impact on my own life. And even in the course of life where we're living in an age of prosperity in the United States, I actually don't have control over making sure that bad things don't come into my life. I can't tell the cancer not to form, and I can't tell the cancer not to go, and I can't tell the cancer to go away. I can't decide when I get the flu. I can't decide when I break a leg. My own life, like my life, the thing that I have the most control over, my life, I can't even actually control that. And God has designed life so that his sovereignty is pounded into us. And that's actually a very generous thing that he does. And so, I just want to reiterate again, one of the main lessons that we should be learning from Ecclesiastes chapter 3. Good times are going to come, bad times are going to come. And the best way that you prepare for tomorrow is by learning to enjoy today. You ultimately don't have the power to stop the bad times from coming. So instead of having all this anxiety about what may or may not come in the future and letting that rob you of your joy in the good times that God's given you, you and I should instead be disciplined to enjoy God's gifts while we have them and to learn to enjoy today. And then when tomorrow comes, whether it be good or bad, we will be better equipped to enjoy it if we learn to enjoy today. And that does not mean being lax. That means also attending to the good responsibilities that God has given us. That there is nothing good in our life except to experience the good that God gives us and to do the good that God has appointed for us. And that's actually a lovely thing. And that's an incredible thing. And that's one of the things that I love about Ecclesiastes, especially Ecclesiastes chapter 3. And so I hope that I've been able to share that with you in a way that's compelling and interesting and understandable. And I hope that this has been as encouraging to you as it has been for me. Like, this has been timely for me. the study that I've done. And so, hey, maybe for one or another of you, this is timely as well. So, with that, let me pray for you. Lord, thank you for the fact that you are sovereign and you are in control. And so when I enter good times in my life and when I enter bad times in my life, I am entering into the time that you have appointed for me. That when I enter those good times, that those are good gifts that you are giving me as the Father of lights. And when I enter bad times, that I can still walk through them knowing that you are my shepherd guiding me with a staff and a rod. Lord, I pray that you would encourage me and also the people listening to this to think about time and to think about life in terms of your sovereignty and to be encouraged by the fact that ultimately there's a lot of limitation on the control that we have, and so we shouldn't be worried about the things that we can't control. But then also we can be encouraged by the fact that the one who does control those things is you, and that you have our best interests at heart, that Romans 8 says that you love us and that everything that happens in our life is ultimately for our good and that you have that intention behind all of it. Lord, we can be encouraged by the fact that we don't have control and so we shouldn't be anxious about the things we can't control, but then also the one who does have control loves us. So there's an ultimate sense in which we shouldn't need to be worried about what's coming down the pipes because you're the one holding the pipes. And so I pray that I would be able to rest in that. That when I look at societal unrest, when I look at trends that are concerning to me, when I think about the fact that my own individual life can be at the mercy of so much good or bad, that instead of being anxious about the future, I pray that I would enjoy the day that you've given me today, and that when tomorrow comes, that I'll enjoy the today that you give to me then. And Lord, I pray the same thing for the people listening to this. And Lord, I pray as well that we would attend to the tasks that you have given us. That we would enjoy the good that you give us in this life, but as verses 12 and 13 say, that we would do the good that you have given to us in this life. And that we would recognize that we might not be able to save the world and change the world, but we can change the worlds of the people that you have placed us around. And Lord, frankly, we can change our own world if we live in the way that you'd have us. And so I pray that you would make us disciplined to do the good things that you have for us to do and to enjoy the good gifts that you've given to us to enjoy. And Lord, I pray these things in the name of our King Jesus Christ. Amen. Thank you for listening to this episode of Shaking Scripture's Leaves. If you have any questions or want to discuss anything from this podcast, you can reach out to me through the contact form on my website. And hey, if you thought that this episode was helpful, then maybe share it with someone else that you think it might be helpful for. And hey, maybe even leave a reaction on the podcast format you're listening on. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll see you next time.